The day my sister turned 16 years old, she got her driver's license, and my parents surprised her with a cherry red 1988 Dodge Shadow.
I said, man, we got to hurry up because we got to go to church, get to church before midnight.
After a formal committee report and the passage of a motion, we became officially the Family Christmas Club.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler. This week, a very special broadcast of our 2019 Stoop Holiday Hootenanny. It's a live-to-tape broadcast. It's going to be the entire show, stories and music.
Featuring music from Baltimore Bluegrass heroes Ken and Brad Kolodner, father and son, Brian Farrow, and Rachel Eddy.
And stories from the Stoop. So enjoy the Stoop Holiday Hootenanny.
Ladies and gentlemen, people of Baltimore, happy, happy holidays, and welcome to the Stoop Holiday Hoopla Extravaganza. It's my pleasure to inform you that you are in attendance at a live taping of a Stoop podcast this evening, coming soon to earbuds near you on your treadmill. Stay tuned. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Thelma and Louise of storytelling, the Laverne and Shirley of narrative nonfiction, your hostesses with the mostesses, Jessica Henkin and Laura Wexler.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out on a Ravens night. I'm sorry about that, those of you that care. Those of you that don't, thank you for being here. I am Jessica Henkin, and this beautiful, tall drink of water next to me is my work wife, Laura Wexler. The man that you heard announce us is actually my real-life husband, Aaron Henkin, who is here tonight with our kids for the first time ever. This is the first time that my kids are seeing a Stoop. Yeah. So I'm going to be behaving myself in a very different way tonight. We want to thank our first podcast sponsor, which is the Park School, which is a pre-K through grade 12 non-sectarian progressive school located right outside of Baltimore, where both of my kids happen to go. But I'm not biased. It's objectively a great school. Okay. So, tonight we have this amazing group of musicians that I could not be more thrilled to have here tonight, because this has been like a dream since we started Stoop, right? I was like, I want to get Ken Kolodner for a holiday show, because nothing says...
And Brad.
But I didn't know about Brad at the time. This is like 11 years ago. Yeah, well, anyway, so... Tonight we have Brad Kolodner, his father, Ken Kolodner, Rachel Eddy, and Brian Farrow. And they are going to be doing this beautiful music for you throughout the evening. So without further ado, I'm going to let you guys get started. Thank you.
Sunday to learn the golden rule. I've adored, I've adored. snow. I've seen the lightning flash and I've heard the thunder roll.
Thanks, guys. That was a great start to the show. And we are going to follow that up with a Stoop story from Michelle Bicotte Jackson, who is a lovely, lovely woman who I had a chance to get to know through her work as diversity director for the YMCA of Central Maryland. She is Baltimore born and bred. She has a BA in computer science and business from Goucher and an MS from Hopkins. And she lives in Owings Mills with her two daughters and her husband. And she's here to share a Christmas tale.
Christmas time in my home growing up was quite the experience, and let me start by giving you a little bit of information about the players that are involved. I was the only girl. I had six brothers, and because they had some other mothers, they were often in and out. And then I had a lot of uncles and cousins who came from different parts of town and stayed with us, so they were often in and out. And then we had some church members and community members. In other words, we were that house where people were often in and out. And at one point, we reached as many as 12 people living in our row home on Edmondson Avenue, complete with marble steps, all at one time. And so needless to say, there was madness. Now, with all the people being in and out, there were two strongholds that were constantly there. They were always in, and they were my mother and my grandmother. And while they were both two very strong women, there was clearly one that was the boss, and that was my grandmother, Susan. She was the matriarch of our home. In fact, she was the matriarch of the entire neighborhood. And what was amazing about her is she was just masterful at managing the house, the funding, just the three-ring circus we called 2924 Edmondson Avenue. But what was also amazing about her was that no matter how crazy things got during the year, and they did get crazy, she was able to pull it together on the Christmas Eve or during the Christmas season because that was her most favorite time of the year. And so how do we know, how do we start our Christmas season off? Well, the tradition was this first, the ceremonial decorating of the house. And because there was very little money, there were very little decorations, so you had the Christmas cards of past placed on tables and taped on walls, and then you had the infamous poinsettia plastic tablecloth with the flannel back. We all had that draped over the dining room table, and then out came the candy dishes that were filled with those old-fashioned hard candies that came from Lexington Market that didn't exist before Christmas Eve and didn't exist after Christmas Day. Special Christmas candies. And then it would not be a table dressed for the holidays if you did not have a whole tray of mixed nuts. And I'm talking about literal nuts, not my family this time, the mixed nuts. And so in addition to that tradition, our most famous tradition was the tradition around getting the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve, always just on Christmas Eve, almost literally hours before Christmas. And so with all those people in the house, it was some permutation of combination of people who would just walk down the street. It was either at a community lot or at a community gas station and buy a tree because it had to be a live tree. And my grandmother always told us, God is not dead, so neither shall our tree be. So we had to have the live tree. So I didn't have the heart to tell her when the tree was cut down, kind of started its descent into death, but it's all good. We know what she meant. So for the most part, we were pretty lucky, got some really nice trees until the infamous Christmas Eve tree of 1979. So what happened in 1979? I was a freshman in high school at the time, and because I'm from Baltimore, you got to rep your high school. I was at Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, and I met a really, really nice man, young man. He was a little older. He was a sophomore, and we became fast friends, and I really wanted to be a little bit more than friends, but he was really comfortable leaving me in the friend zone. And so I said, well, what can I do to impress this older man? So I said, I'm going to invite him to my house on Christmas Eve because it's relatively festive, and it's one of 2 or 3 days of the entire year where my home is relatively calm and safe. And so what I did was agreed to meet up with him at this transfer bus stop so that we could arrive at the house together. And I was pleasantly surprised to arrive to the house and get to the vestibule and smell this wonderful sweet scent of pine. And I'm thinking, yay, my grandmother actually got the tree a little earlier. This is going to be so nice. It's going to be beautiful. He is going to be so impressed. Until I took 2 steps in and actually saw the tree. And let's just say 1979 was not a good year. And neither was it a good tree. In fact, it wasn't even a tree. It was actually 6 to 7 branches that my grandmother had gotten a strand of lights and tied them around the branches. And because she was so masterful, she was able to tie them and give them a little bit of height, which allowed her to then add ornaments and candy canes to these branches. So if you can't get the visual, I want you to think about that bonfire twig thing that you normally see in campfires with green pines and ornaments in the middle of our living room for in all its splendor. So needless to say, my friend's looking at me, I'm looking down because I'm mortified. So he kept it together until he took his seat, which placed him front and center of this tree. And then he just lost it. He just lost it. He falls on the floor. He's laughing. He can't get himself together. And I, again, just was aghast. And so what happened, obviously, was his visit was very brief. And I forever stayed in the friend zone. But that's not the point. So afterward, I have a little debrief with my grandmother. We had to talk about this respectfully, of course, because that was the only way you talked to my grandmother. And I told her I was a little embarrassed, and why'd you pick that tree, and why do you do this thing on Christmas Eve anyway? Because this is what can happen. This is what happens when you make decisions like this on Christmas Eve. And so she said, well, I didn't mean to embarrass you, but it was all they had left, and I figured something was better than nothing. Totally disagreed with that. So once we, you know, fast forward kind of 30 years and my grandmother's health is starting to decline. And so we're starting to have these bedside conversations of a lifetime. And on this particular evening, it was about Christmas traditions. And so she asked me, did I remember that we always got the tree on Christmas Eve? And I said, of course I do. And she said, do you remember why? And I said, yes, it was a tradition. In fact, it was your tradition. And she said, yeah, well, kind of. But the real reason was getting the tree on Christmas Eve was so much cheaper and in many times free, which allowed me to be able to buy a little bit more food for all those in and out loved ones and to make sure that you and your brothers got at least 2 toys every year. So while I was so busy, focused on, wrapped up in that whole tradition, just like she wrapped those lights around those branches, I'm forever scarred. But what I realized the tradition she was really trying to impart was the importance of holding fast to those things that are truly, truly important to you, and then doing what you got to do to make sure that they are held sacred. And so for my grandmother, it was clear. It was, God is not dead, so our tree will never be, and always put the care and love of family first. So on that note, may you all have a happy and blessed holiday. I'm off to a tree lot. Thank you.
Okay, so our next storyteller, I want to just say, so I went to Catholic school all my life in Annapolis, and if you've been to the Stoop in the past, you might have heard me say a thing or two about that. And our next storyteller made me feel really safe immediately and gave me a lot of hope and peace, and that is an enormous thing, given that she is the prioress of the Benedictine Sisters of the Baltimore Emmanuel Monastery. Prior to that, she was both a teacher and a pastoral associate for more than 15 years in Baltimore City. She is a spiritual director, a retreat director, and is very active in justice and peace ministry. So please welcome Sister Patricia Kirk.
My story is what we call the new Christmas story. It happened on December 28th of 2010. And Molly, who is our development director, called us and said she had gotten a phone call from somebody from United Way that there was this woman that just came into the States from another country and she had nowhere to go. And they checked other places in Baltimore City, and because it was between Christmas and New Year's, there really was no place else to go. So she called us and said, can she come to the monastery? And we said, sure. And we had done this for other people before, too. So she brings Kayla to the monastery, and she said, and by the way, she's pregnant. I said, oh, okay. So, but she said, don't worry, I can tell she's at least 4 to 6 weeks out. And because Molly is a mother, we said, oh, well, we could trust you. Okay. That was the wrong thing. Because her baby, well, she started with contractions and bleeding the first night that she was there at our monastery. And one of the sisters came to get me and said, we're in trouble. I said, call 911. So we called 911, and when I called there, I said, we want to go to Mercy Hospital. And she said, ma'am, we'll decide where she's going to go. I said, fine. Okay, so they get to the monastery, and I did my same routine of, we want to go to, fine. So I went in the ambulance with Kayla and a driver. We go down to the end of our drive, and the driver says to me, I'm new to the area. This is my first day. So you'll have to direct me to Mercy Hospital. I said, yes. Emmanuel, God with us. So we go down the end, and I said, okay, take a left, and then take another left. We're going down to 83, and it was smooth. So we get to the hospital, and the Mercies are very welcoming people. The wheelchair is there, bring her upstairs, and she did not have the baby that day, but it was a great routine. So they checked her out and could see that the baby was right where the baby should have been, and did a lot of different testing, you know, x-rays and so on. So it was a blessed time. So I called Molly and said, guess what? Didn't happen today. So we went back home. And then on January the 6th, which is the Feast of the Epiphany, we go through the same thing again. Bleeding, contractions. I said, this time, I'm not calling 911. We're going to go in the car, Kayla, and we're just going to go down. So hold on. 4 o'clock in the morning, 83. Never knew there were so many holes, so many ruts in 83. And we get down there, and they just whisk her right up to maternity area, and she's crying. Molly now is crying because she came down. And they were just so wonderful to her. And one of the other blessings was there was a woman who was a doctor there, and she happened to speak the same language, the same dialect as Kayla. And so she was really calming her, you know, your mama's here, your grandma's here, it's going to be okay, in that language, I mean, not English. And even though Kayla spoke English, just to hear somebody of your own language was just a fantastic thing. So it took about 6 or 7 hours before she was really ready to deliver. And so they said to us, Molly, you take her and steady her on one side, and sister, you just hold her down on the other side, because we wanted to just, you know, not any, you know, moving around. So, okay. So Molly's, the blood is going out of her face. And I said, Molly, you have 2 kids. She said, but I've never been at that end. I said, ah, okay. So baby was delivered, little boy, beautiful little boy. They stayed in the hospital a couple of days, and the president of Mercy came down to greet her. And she said, isn't that nice that they come and they greet every new mother and baby? I said, no, they don't do that. They're very nice, but they don't do that. So anyway, Molly, so what Kayla wanted her to do was, I want to go to the mosque because I want my baby to be blessed. So they stopped by the mosque on the way back to our monastery, and she came back. And you have to know, okay, monasteries, sisters, they've never been married, they've never had children, so now we have this baby in our home. And it was a thrilling, thrilling experience for all of the community and for everybody that comes to our monastery, that we welcomed this Muslim woman to our home. And in the days before, actually, that she delivered, we had already taken her for a doctor, already had taken her to get her her documents, see whether, you know, she really could be welcomed, you know, safety. It was a safety issue. But we learned so much from being involved in this. And when they were saying about justice and peace, my whole community is like that, of what does it take in our country right now to welcome people from other countries? And they are a blessing to us. So, so having this Muslim woman who is a devout Muslim, 5 times a day she had brought her prayer rug with her. So guess what? Grandmas would take the baby, rock the baby, put him in the carriage, you know, get him to stop crying, yelling, whatever. And it was just, it touched so many people. I guess I just can't emphasize that enough. Then after that experience, we have had other women that have come, and just for a period of time, we've had 3 other women that have come to our monastery, and they now are married, have children, and stay in relationship with us. And what one of the things we learned was how difficult it is for somebody coming from another country. You know, how to go through the legal system, how to go through insurance. One of the things that we did in that interim between January 1st and when the baby was born was to take her to a food store where she can get her own kind of food, not our food, her own kind of food. You know, but the adaptation that they experience is just incredible. And they only come because of safety. They don't come for a better life. They come for a safe life. And that needs to be remembered. Oh. But I have to say, for some of the sisters, this was, and I said, we're all grandmas, obviously. And when the baby was starting to crawl, would go across the hall because one of our sisters had all these stuffed animals on her bed. And so he knew right away where to go, who was going to take care of him. And then there was another sister who said, well, I'll teach him how to roll over. And you'd have to see this sister. This is the way you do it. You roll over and And then you find your way, and then we get them up. I could tell you so many stories, but I just have 7 minutes to do this. So, but I guess that whole sense of Emmanuel, God with us, our Christmas story, I hope you take that home with you, because it is, it's not about a certain tradition. It's about a new way of life. It's about a new way of being and welcoming the stranger into your home. And you never regret it. Amen.
Thank you, Sister Tricia. Kayla and her son lived at the monastery for 2.5 years. So the sisters got to watch this baby, grow through the 2.5 years. And then they, felt secure and went on and moved out. And she applied for asylum, was able to bring her husband over. They had another child, but the little boy who spent his first 2.5 years at Emmanuel Monastery comes back every week to do his homework and eat dinner with the sisters and play his Game Boy. So it truly is a new nativity story. And out of this experience, 9 religious communities started in January 2011, an organization called Asylee Women's Enterprise. And to help women, but also now men, who are coming into this country, coming into BWI Airport, planning to apply for asylum, and really in limbo until all of that goes through. And so you can learn more about Asylee Women's Enterprise. Just earlier this week, they were able to find housing for a woman who was about to get booted out of juvenile shelter into an adult shelter where she would have been separated from her child. And they were able to prevent that and find shelter. So please check them out. Asylee Women's Enterprise, they have a table in the lobby and you can hear about them. Learn about them. Okay, so now moving from a Muslim and Catholic sisters to a nice Jewish boy, Josh Kahn. And Josh Kahn is the program director at Creative Alliance. He brings amazing events and talent to the Creative Alliance, which is where the Stoop got its start and still has shows, and so encourage you all to check out their amazing offerings. But tonight, Josh has a story to tell about a very memorable incident that happened 1 year while everybody else was celebrating Christmas. And, he was doing what all Jews do, which is eat Chinese food, go to JCC, and, hang out. Okay, welcome, Josh.
Hi. So July 26, 1979, my sister Rebecca Emily Kahn was born. And then a quick 16 months later, I was born. And in my sister's retelling of her life, she will tell you she had 16 months of everything, and then I came along behind her and destroyed it all. The day my sister turned 16 years old, she got her driver's license, and my parents surprised her with a cherry red 1988 Dodge Shadow. Now, I don't want you to be caught up by the mystical name and the color. This was not a hot rod. This was a dump of a car. This was U.S. automobile manufacturing in the 80s. This was like the epitome of everything that went wrong in this industry. It was like 2 tin boxes stacked on top of each other, painted red, lined with plastic. Nothing worked. But that didn't matter because this was my sister's car, and she loved it. It was her first car, and she took so much pride in it. And for 16 months, she drove it around Northeast Philadelphia with just a great sense of ownership and being. And then 16 months later, it was my birthday, and what did I get for my birthday? The keys to my sister's car. So this is Northeast Philadelphia in the mid-90s, and we were young, and we were wild, and we were Jewish. And while everybody else was celebrating Christmas over the Christmas break, we were part of this Jewish youth group, and we had a convention of Jewish youth groups that was going to be happening in North Jersey. And my sister was a big shot in this Jewish youth group. So she went up a couple days in advance, but I was not a big shot. And so I was going to take the charter bus, which was leaving from the Jewish Community Center of Northeast Philadelphia, up 95. And so this is a little before Christmas. And school ended, and I hopped into the 1988 Dodge Shadow, and I drove to the JCC parking lot. It was jumping. Like, it was really rocking over there at the JCC. And I guess there was, like, a gym in there, and maybe everybody's working off their calories because they're going to gorge themselves on Chinese food, whatever it was. There was no parking spots except all the way in the far corner of the lot where the street lights didn't hit, you know, where all the broken glass was, you know, that spot that you never want to park in. That was the only spot left. And I drove the car over there and I parked it and I didn't really think anything of it. And I grabbed my bags and I locked the car and then I went to the Jewish Youth Group convention. And now it's like 20 some odd years later. And to be honest, I don't remember a thing that happened at that convention. What I do remember is getting off the bus on our way back. And my sister is with me at this point. And we get off the bus and we look in the parking lot and we don't see the gleam coming off the red of the Dodge Shadow. And then I remembered I parked the car all the way in that corner in that spot. And so I walked over to the corner of the lot and there, still warm to the touch, was the burnt out shell of my sister's happiness. Yeah, now it was, this car was burnt to a crisp, and I honestly probably wouldn't even thought it was our car, except my homework was sitting kind of burnt off to the side of the car, and I knew it was our car at that point. And my sister, her rage just glowed at that moment. She was sure that I had done something wrong. If I didn't personally just like leave the car on or something to light it on fire, then what idiot parks their car in that spot in the lot? Well, eventually the police came and they kind of tempered her rage a little bit. They said a few other cars had had some minor vandalism, so she calmed down a little bit. And then the police, we got to love the police, they said, but you know what? Your car probably got caught on fire because you left it in this dark spot in the corner of the lot. And then her rage just burnt with a passion that only a sibling's rage can burn. And it was a rage that lasted throughout the Christmas break into early 1997. The new year came. When we got this bill in the mail. Now, what we forgot was in the trunk of the car was one of those old cellular telephones. You know, before the days of smartphones, there were those bag phones, those cellular phones that you would keep in your car and you plug into your lighter, and they charge you like $5-7 a minute. And my parents, under no uncertain terms, were we allowed to use this phone except for in case of emergency. So it just really sat in our car. Despite this car being a piece of junk, we rarely had to pull the phone out. But we get this bill in the mail, and there's seven phone calls made, all originating on the night that this car was blown up. This is the part of the story where I introduce my mother. My mother's a very interesting human being. She taught for 33 years high school in the Philadelphia School District. And she's one of those people, I think you know these people, they are teachers for so long that the line between home life and teaching life is really blurred. She would always speak at like a very high volume, like she was lecturing us and my friends. She had this weird obsession about wearing hats inside. But most importantly, she had just like this deep intrinsic understanding of the stupidity of teenagers, which was very beneficial to me. So we get this bill in the mail, and what she might have done at this point was call the police and turn this over, but that's not what she did. What she did was she took the seven numbers and divided them up amongst my sister and I and said, okay, you guys are calling these and figuring out who let the car on fire. So we don't disagree with our mother ever because she talks very loudly. And so we started calling these numbers. Now, do you know the term snitches get stitches? You know that? Well, In the winter of 1997 in Northeast Philadelphia, loose lips sank ships, and at the end of every one of those calls was a teenager, and they all flipped. They all turned up in one kid. They're like, oh, it's this one guy. So we knew who it was, and we went to my mother, and we said every number was a teenager, and everyone said it was this one kid who did it. Now, what my mother could have done at this point was she could have called the police, but she didn't do that. What she did was call this kid up. And she didn't. He picked up the phone, but then she asked for his mom, which is like as a kid, that's the worst thing. And over a series of conversations, over a course of a few days, she learned a lot about this kid and found out that he was going through a really tough period of his life and was skipping school a lot and getting into a lot of trouble. And so she made a deal with the parents. She said, "Okay, I can either once again I can call the police and turn your son in, or he can start going to therapy, and then he can get a job." And he himself has to pay us the difference between the insurance money we got for the 1988 Dodge Shadow and the fancy 1989 Toyota Camry, Japanese made, very nice car. And so, of course, they took that deal. And then for a couple years, every week or so, we would get in the mail an envelope. And in the envelope would be like $30 or $40 that he would make slinging pizzas at the Northeast Philadelphia Pizza Joint. And then every Christmas, we would get a letter. And that letter, he would recount all the good things that happened to his life since that moment my mother called his mother. Very beautiful thing. And that's kind of the end of the story. There's no, like, Hollywood ending where, like, you know, he marries my sister or, like... They come over for Thanksgiving. We like, you know, he paid off his debt and we stopped hearing about him. And that's the end of the story. Right? But I think about the story now a lot because in the age of social media, if this in 2019 this happened, what would have happened is my sister and I would have gotten off the bus and then we would have seen the burnt out shell of her happiness. And we would have taken a photo on our cell phones and we would have posted it to Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram or whatever the kids are using these days. And it would have gone viral as an act of anti-Semitism. And how wrong would that have been? I mean... He lit a car on fire on Christmas at a Jewish community center parking lot. But that's not what happened. So I hope wherever he is, you know, he's probably about my age now, and I hope that he can take a moment and be thankful that he was a stupid kid at a time when it was okay to be a stupid kid and that his path crossed paths with my mother.
I'm going to say a word about the instruments we're playing. This over here is a hammer dulcimer. Brad has got the gourd banjo. And this instrument that I'm about to play is called a hammered imbira. And it's kind of like a hammer dulcimer with metal rods. And this guy in Oregon got the idea to try and capture the sound of an African instrument called the imbira in the layout of a hammer dulcimer. So an imbira is also known as the thumb piano. This next tune that we're going to play is a tune that I wrote on a beautiful snowy day up in Vermont. We were staying in a place called the Swift House, and I wasn't feeling so good because I had just broken my hand, and we were on a family ski trip. Could not ski, but I could play music, and I wrote this tune called the Swift House. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, so that is our first half. We want to thank two of our sponsors for the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. The first is Baltimore Magazine. They've been a longtime supporter, such a high-quality magazine. We love it. We love Max Weiss and everything it's about. We want to thank Golden West, which has been a wonderful supporter of the Stoop podcast. If you ever want to have the most delicious brunch in the world, go to the Avenue in Hamden and treat yourself. You won't regret it. So thank you so much for enjoying the first half. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. We're going to get started with the second half of the show. So now, without further ado, we're going to have another song from the Kolodners and Rachel Eddy, and we're back with the bass. It has been resurrected.
One, two, three. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so on to the next storyteller. His name is Jolet Kelly Josue. I really love saying that. Jolet Kelly Josue. And he is a Bahamian-born Haitian-American author and physician. In fact, he has books out in the lobby that he wrote and was happy to tell you about it. He's here to share a story about a very memorable Christmas that he had when he was a kid. So please welcome. He goes by Kelly. Please welcome Kelly.
I was 4 years old when my parents moved from the Bahamas, where I was born, to Haiti, to a small coastal city in the northwest part of Haiti. Basically, they wanted us to have some cultural roots to grow up within our own culture. It's a place where everyone knows everyone, everyone looks after each other. And 3 years later, my dad died of tetanus. I was just 8 years old. There were five of us children. And we ranged from age 9 to 2 years old. So that's a lot of mouths to feed. My mother, a few months after that, she left for the U.S. In search of work so she could find money to send back to support us. At first, we lived in a house by ourselves, all five of us, and there were no bed. There were some no furniture, but two beds. And our Aunt Anne looked after us. She would come morning and day to make sure we were being fed and going to school. So eventually, we were moved from house to house and until I was 11 years old. That's when my Uncle Frank, uncle by marriage, found out that we're not being taken care of properly, he decided to take us in permanently. So that's where I really wanted to be, because Uncle Frank, we knew him since I was in the Bahamas. And plus, even when my parents were around, I spent a lot of time playing with his children. Uncle Frank was kind of a James Earl Jones lookalike, but with a softer voice. And so he had 9 children already. We always joked at our house, he was such a Christian man that he took the Bible literally. You know that part of the Bible where he said you have to be fruitful and multiply. So I'm not going to go. But he was a very successful man. Actually, he was one of the hardest working men. I always thought that he probably raised me better than my dad did because of his values. And so he was very successful selling coffee as a middleman. He had a bus traveling from the capital, Port-au-Prince, to our hometown, shuttling passengers. But my best part was that he had a lot of farms. So many farms along one of the main rivers where I would go eating mangoes, avocados. But my best part also was riding donkeys with my cousins. So, very fair and compassionate man, but also very strict. He was a deacon at the Baptist church. He didn't tolerate anyone coming to complain about your bad behaviors. He also had to make sure that we go to church four times. We had some church activities 4 times a week. Sunday morning was mandatory. You had to be on your deathbed for you not to go to church. And so when he finally took us in, that first Christmas, I was going to spend it with my cousins, one of his son and one of my older cousins, Zach, who was 7 years older than me. Christmas Eve was a big thing for us Baptists because we don't have much fun. Baptists, we like, I always wondered, like, I said, you know, I have a little ADHD, and I cannot take 4 hours listening to the adult waiting for Jesus Christ to come back. It's like, that's too much. So Christmas Eve was the best part. We have that nativity scene, theatrical. I said, okay, that's good. But Zach, who's older, we listened to him. He decided that we were going to celebrate Christmas in a special way by making a mild alcoholic drink. So made of sugarcane, rum, Haitian rum, and squeezed lemon juice. Mind you, I never tasted alcohol. Actually, it's actually not allowed in the house. We didn't keep it. We didn't touch it. You didn't smell it. You didn't go around people holding alcohol. But so it was a forbidden fruit for me because Catholics, I always complain, the Catholics, they're having all the fun. It's like, I know, if you know, in Haiti, during like Christmas time, by January, that's when they're having First Communion. The kids would be having communions. All of a sudden, you'd see them tipsy. They're like, but they wouldn't beat them. But my uncle, he would not tolerate people drinking alcohol. So Zach said, okay, Kelly, go buy the rum so we can make the drink because we had to go to church at midnight. You have to be at church before midnight. So I went three houses down, went to buy the rum at one of my classmates' house. His name was Simon. So I went there. In Haiti, we had a lot of houses with front stores where they sell sodas and all kind of stuff. My classmates' parents, they were one of the biggest rum sellers. So I showed up. There were two big kerosene gas lamps with those nice shapes. So I'm hiding, trying for the glare of the light not to give off my identity, because if she saw me, she could call my uncle, tell him that I came to a house and buy rum, and I would be in big trouble. So I came, I showed up, I said, okay, can I get 25 cents of rum, around 8 ounces? I gave her my jar. I was taking the rum back. On my way back, there was an empty lot where we used to play soccer. I stopped there. I said, okay, this is my moment. I am going to feel what it's like to feel good like that, because these folks are having too much fun. So there was noise around the streets. I said, okay, let me block this. So I took the jar. I downed half of it. And that was the most bitter thing I ever tasted. And I felt like there were like pens stinging in my head. I said, is that what you have to go to get the fun? It's like, so I had to rush back. Zach was waiting for the rum. And when I came, he said, Kelly, where's the rum? He lifted it up. He said, it's half full. I said, Zach, it spilled while I was running. I said, man, we got to hurry up because we got to go to church, get to church before midnight. He mixed the rum, the sugar cane, the squeezed lemon juice, and he gave me mine. By the time, I was half drunk. I mean, half drunk, I don't know what you mean. Can you be half pregnant? So he gave me mine. I washed up, got dressed. I'm going to church. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember getting to church. I don't remember getting back home. I don't know how I got back home. The joke is, so the next morning, I find myself waking up on the side of the bed with my feet dangling. I was in a daze and I was trying to figure out what happened. Then I was wearing a white t-shirt. I looked down, I was full of mud. And it seems like the food I ate was all over the shirt. The smell was, I had one of the biggest headaches. While I was recovering and the kids, my cousin and my sisters came, they said, Kelly, what happened? I said, what happened? They said, you went to the church in the back. You were singing, yelling. Basically, you were singing out of tune when no one was singing. I said, okay. And while they were saying that, I said, okay, I'm done. I hope Uncle Frank didn't see me because as a deacon, he always sat up front. I said, obviously, I didn't go up front. But one of the kids went, probably told him. Then while they were telling me that I was still recovering, Uncle Frank had these kids, those big kids. You could hear like he was passing by swinging them. And I heard those kids coming. I said, okay. Then the door opened and he looked at me, gave me this look, this purpose look. I don't know what I'm going to do with you. Basically, I thought I was done because the worst thing is that he could have kicked me out because drinking alcohol was a no-no. Then I was waiting days, like the day after, for him to call me. He never called me. I was so relieved that somehow he forgave me. And mind you, that's one of the nicest childhood I spent at his house because he was well-to-do and with my cousins and my friends. So that was the best Christmas I ever had. And I stayed at his house 5 more years until I came to the U.S., So thank you. See you.
I've
grabbed the gourd banjo yet again here. So the banjo originally comes from Africa, and this is kind of what it might have looked like way back in the day. This instrument was built here in Baltimore by a great builder over in Waverly named Pete Ross. And some of you may not be aware, but the banjo was first mass-produced here in Baltimore City, right down there on the block on Park Avenue, or on Baltimore Street. Yeah, that's where the banjo was first mass-produced back in the mid-1800s. We're going to do a song here, though, that is played here on the gourd and the hammered dulcimer and guitar here. And I, of course, grew up around this music and had to listen to it whether I liked it or not. My father has been playing music since I was a little kid. And, of course, grew up around all kinds of great traditional folk music from all over the world. We'll do a song here that I learned from a recording that was just laying around the house growing up from a great songwriter named Kate Wolf. It's a song of hers named called Across the Great Divide.
I've been walking in my sleep, counting troubles instead of counting sheep. Where the years went, I can't say. I just turned around, they've gone away. I've been sifting through the layers of dusty books and faded papers. They tell the story I used to know. It was one that happened so long ago. It's gone away in yesterday, and I find myself on mountainside where the rivers change direction across the Great Divide. Softly as the night was falling, with a question, and I replied, but he's gone across the borderline. It's gone away in yesterday, and I find myself on the mountainside where the rivers change direction.
Thanks again. The band, just so you know, if you are looking for stocking stuffers or any ideas such as that, they have merch out in the lobby, CDs for sale, as well as Cholet's book is for sale, so keep that in mind. So our next storyteller actually did a stoop, 12 years ago, 10 years ago, when we were at Creative Alliance. And so it's always fun to have someone back. She's here tonight with many folks from her family. I know specifically her husband and her daughter. Her name is Maura Taylor. And she's going to share with you a story that I find just very delightful. It's a quintessential Baltimore story. So please welcome Maura.
Good evening. My name is Maura Taylor, and my family's story begins over 70 years ago, when my great-grandparents' small West Baltimore row house grew too tiny for their big Irish family to all have Christmas dinner together. So they pooled their resources and they rented a hall nearby. It was successful. So they took the next logical step and they formed a family club. Yes, it was an official club. We assessed dues at $2 a month per family. We established committees, and we elected officers. And of course, all of our family meetings were run per Robert's Rules, as most family meetings are. Then in 1954, after a formal committee report and the passage of a motion, we became officially the Family Christmas Club, hereafter referred to as the Family Club. Passing formal bylaws in 1955. And in 1956, after three meetings worth of discussion, we were able to purchase our first gavel for $3.06. Now, the mission, per the Family Club bylaws, was to keep the families of the charter members, my grandmother, her six siblings, and their spouses, together, to pool their resources to help those in need, and to smooth over any family rifts that might occur. For the better part of 70-plus years, I think that we've remained true to that mission. When I was a small child, I loved family meetings. I loved getting together with my cousins. I had no idea then that the parliamentary procedure that I was somehow learning was going to help me in my governance career later in life. In the 1990s, I was elected secretary of the family club. I took that role very seriously because that's the kind of person I am. I kept track of family events, the birthdays. I sent out quarterly family newsletters. I now administer the Family Club Facebook page as we're moving into this new century. In 2015, after a formal motion was passed and through a lot of discussion, we moved family Christmas dinner away from Christmas Day and onto a weekend in December, with quite a bit of grumbling, I might add, from some older generations and even some younger ones. And I have to admit it was difficult for me as well because I couldn't imagine not spending Christmas at the hall. Well, you know, we all don't live in West Baltimore anymore. People's lives get complicated. Our family got a lot bigger. And so we realized that in order to maintain this tradition that was so very dear to us, we had to tweak it. And so that's what we did. Now, my Uncle Joe and I, he's 93, one of the charter members, we have an ongoing debate about what was the actual starting year of the family club. Last year, I decided it was our 70th anniversary, and I wanted to make it special. Family meeting was called, motions were made, assignments were given. We rented the Ferndale Volunteer Fire Department Hall. I created a special invitation, family club trivia, gathered pictures of all my family members, and we were off and running. Now, then I began to go through a treasure trove of family club minutes. Yes, we kept formal minutes. These date back to the early 50s. They're tight. Yeah, and as I was reading through them, I learned that the purchase of whiskey and beer, high priority, worthy of a lot of discussion in my family. We're a big Irish family. That's what we talk about. And in 1953, it was so specific that we had to purchase a gallon of Mogan David wine. It was noted in the minutes. Later, there was an official motion to purchase 2/5 of whiskey. As I dug through the receipts, I found out that in 1971, we spent $110 renting the hall and $108 on beer. That must have been quite a year. Quite a year. Nowadays, it's BYOB. And then there's the food. Well, in the early days, a lot of the food was purchased, actually, and then some prepared. But when I was a little girl, it was mostly prepared. And when if I just close my eyes, I can put myself right back in that hot hall kitchen with my grandmother and my aunts and my mom and all the female relatives cooking up our Christmas dinner while the men set the table and ran the bar. Now we do a potluck dinner, but it has to absolutely include turkey, mashed potatoes, and cranberry sauce. Otherwise, my Uncle Walt says it's not real Christmas dinner. One year, we tried to pitch heavy hors d'oeuvres. That was vetoed. So back to last year. The planning was in full throttle. Everything was set to go. And then on November 10th, I unexpectedly lost my dad. Now, my dad loved the family club, having become an official member in 1962. Well, the world around me was falling apart, but Christmas needed to happen. I knew it needed to happen because it has been the glue that's held my family together quite literally for generations. And honestly, last year, I really needed that big Irish family. So on December 8th, we gathered, and my heart was full as I watched my 93-year-old Aunt Mary flitting around the room, delighted every time she found a picture of herself. She wasn't so interested in everyone else. Let me tell you. The family club trivia was set. The older generation, sure they were going to win. And Santa was on the way. That's right, folks. I forgot to mention, Santa has been coming to my family Christmas for 70 years. My Uncle Joe led us off in prayer, as he always does. And about 75 of us, four generations, gathered and had dinner together. Santa gave out gifts to excited little ones. My cousin Donna's team surprised everyone by winning family club trivia. Pictures were taken and carols were sung. This weekend, my family will be gathering at the Halethorpe Community Center for our 71st or so, depends on if you talk to Uncle Joe or me, and Christmas dinner. And at last count, there's around 60 of us and four generations. We will all be grateful and in that moment for that quirky idea that my grandmother, her six siblings, and their spouses had more than 70 years ago to officially establish the Family Christmas Club, complete with formal meetings and bylaws, because it set up a structure and laid a foundation for future generations of my family that has kept us together and held this tradition, which, as my Aunt Betty says, makes us a remarkable family. So, on behalf of my remarkable Irish family, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all of you. And if any of you are looking to set up a family club, I've got a really good example of bylaws for you. Thank you.
That was wonderful. I'd like to be a member of Family Club, if you would have me. Before we move to our next storyteller, I do want to thank our final podcast sponsor, which is The Wine Source in Hamden. I don't know if you're familiar with it. That round of applause is earned. That place is fucking awesome. It just is. Excuse my language, but it just is. It's like at the best price points for like the wine that you want to bring to the party to be that classy person. The beer is very good. They always have like fancy little chocolates. If you don't know what I'm talking about, please get there. The Wine Source. You won't regret it. Unless you're a recovering alcoholic, in which case you should not go there. I mean, it's just that's bad choice making on your part. Okay. Our next storyteller is He is a family. I get to call him a family friend. That feels so lucky to me. He and my husband met years ago through just being smart, artistic men. I don't know how they met. How'd you guys meet? And he works as a folklorist. And he does very good things to help. Wow. Anyway, please welcome Cliff Murphy. Oh my God.
That was an amazing introduction. It's made me a lot less nervous. I guess that makes me like the St. Nicholas of this area. I'm here to talk to you about an important family issue today, and I want to thank my friends, my fellow storytellers, for sharing some heartfelt stories, and I'm going to do a little bit of that. Just a show of hands here, people who are familiar with vomiting children. Okay, this is an area of expertise of mine. I have four kids, and two of them are prodigious vomiters. And especially when we're in the car, we call it the vomitorium. We live about a mile from here, and we go often to Philadelphia, where my wife's family lives. And we'll all get in the car, and about, 2 minutes down the road, one of my kids will say, "Hey, look, it's the Towson Library." And then the other kid will just start throwing up in the backseat. And that's how we roll. So I'm curious, for people here, how many people here have experienced the curse? And what I mean by that is that moment in childhood where one of your parents, in this case my mother, kind of, if you're, misbehaving, being lazy, being all around no good, they look at you and they say, "I hope you have kids just like you someday." For me, or for my children, it's more of a mosaic, right? Like, there's not one that's exactly like me. They all kind of have inherited parts of that curse, that I've passed on. And car sickness is really one of them. I was the kid in the family who, on family trips, if it was 2 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles, 100 miles, my brother and sister would fight over who had to sit next to me in the car. And so my bile filled the back seat of our family vehicle. And, my mother didn't put that curse on me while I was getting sick, in her defense, Anyhow, a different question, maybe a weird follow-up. Are there any Polish Americans here tonight? All right. I know you, and I love you. I'm not one of you, but I am married to one of you. I'm married to a Pole, and I've spent the last 20 years in Polish-American boot camp, so I know the Bocis and the Chuchis and the Kruszczykis and the Golumki and all of that. And it's a wonderful way of life. My wife's Polish ancestors, her grandparents came over from Poland and settled in Philadelphia in a row home. And their house, this was a little bit after World War I, their family kind of, that became the place that friends and relatives who came from Poland stayed there for a little while. They got themselves settled, and then they'd move on to wherever it was that they lived. Now, everybody who kind of passed through that house became this big, sprawling, beautiful, tight family, right? And it's I'm assuming that's a Polish thing, is that tightness, right? Like, people want to be together, right? Like, we're going on vacation and we're all going together. And that's, again, that's how we roll. So, all right, now, it's not every day in America that a white male Irish Catholic seems exotic. But when I arrived on the scene, it was sort of like, that part of a Western where the saloon doors open and the piano stops, right? My loving wife, was the first of her siblings to get married, right? So I was the new guy. And our first married Christmas in Philadelphia, there I hear some knowing chuckles. So our first married Christmas in Philadelphia, I was the new guy, right? And everybody was having to adjust to the new guy. And somebody, you know, there's kind of two parts of the family, right? There's the family, the big chunk that lives in Philly, and then there's the big chunk that lives in Trenton, New Jersey. And so this Christmas, you know, somebody had said, hey, let's all get together and let's get a post-Christmas buffet somewhere, right? So now, if somebody said to you, anyone in the room, like, can you name a good place for breakfast within an hour of Philadelphia? Just a show of hands, how many people would naturally say the Trenton Airport, right? So that was a bad idea coming down the pike. So, you know, I got over my car sickness roughly around the time that I was 20, I think. I guess that's when you stop seeing a pediatrician, right? That was kind of, you know, it for me. So, but like any childhood trauma, these things kind of periodically, like, creep back into your life, right? They're like, hello, I'm still in here, right? So, anyhow, so I get in my father-in-law's car in Philadelphia. I'm like an oversized man-child in the back seat. And we start driving to Trenton. And there's my old childhood affliction. It's starting to creep up in my belly. And I get that pre-vomit tingle, which is followed by the pre-vomit sweat, right? And so by the time we've pulled into the parking lot of the General's Quarters, perhaps you've heard of that restaurant, I was a wreck, and through some act of God, I hadn't gotten sick, right? So we walk into the General's Quarters. It's a buffet breakfast, and I don't know about you, but when I don't feel good, the sight and smell and kind of quivering texture of big pans of scrambled eggs is not my thing, right? I just, so I do what anybody would do, and I make a beeline for the chocolate cake and the bacon, right? And so, you know, the family, extended family, is feasting on all the eggs, and I've got my bacon and I've got my cake. And I eat it, and it settles my stomach, because that's what happens, right? So we talk about the Eagles. We talk about, you know, traffic. We all have a good time, get back in the car, drive back to Philadelphia. So we're there for a couple hours, no problems driving home. I'm not sick anymore. And I don't know, after about a couple hours, you know, we're sitting there together, because that's what you do. And my brother-in-law, John, runs down the hall, and I want to emphasize the word runs there. Now, there's a metrics system for bathroom going, right? So, like, we all know this, right? Like, in polite company, there's number one and number two, right? Now, there's a dark side to the metric system, which is that there are numbers after one and two. And so I love my brother-in-law, John. He's well known in the family for a weak stomach. And what I mean is he's familiar with number three. And so he's in the bathroom, and my wife is on the other side of the door asking if he's okay. And by this point, he's feeling number three and number four. And pretty soon, my wife is as well, and then my mother-in-law. And so they're my mother-in-law and my wife are very selfless, empathetic people. And so, you know, my brothers-in-law and my father-in-law were like, well, maybe it's sympathy sickness. Like, maybe they just feel badly for Johnny. And like, well, then my father-in-law goes down. And then my brother-in-law, Frank, goes down. And so by New Year's Eve morning, it's me and Joe, right? We're the only ones left standing. And at this point, you know, new guy here, right? Like, I'm running out to, I'm like showing my worth, right? Like, as the new guy, I'm buying toilet paper, I'm buying Pedialyte, right? I'm making sure everybody's hydrated. And I realize I haven't seen Joe in a little bit. And at this point, Monica's feeling a little bit better, and she's like, hey, where's Joe? I was like, I don't know. I haven't seen that guy in a while. So she runs upstairs, and there he is. He's a big man. You know, the kind of brother-in-law that men of my size tend to quake when they see a person of this size. And there, so Monica finds Joe, and he's fully naked on the floor of the bathroom, begging God for mercy. And so a little while later, after proving my value while also kind of worrying that the family thinks I've poisoned them, the phone rings, and it's the Trenton relatives, right? And they're like, hey, how you guys feeling over there? And it turns out 39 out of 40 of us got food poisoning. And I was the only one who didn't. And that is the miracle of that particular Christmas, which, for those of you who need a takeaway message, is that when in doubt, stick with bacon and chocolate cake, and you are good to go.
Thank you for that vivid story, and for now knowing that there are more numbers beyond two. You've really given me a lot to think about. Thank you. So we've come to our final storyteller of the evening. Her name is Ariane Rice, and she is an Episcopal priest. So we're heavy hitters with the religious folk here tonight. And she's been a priest for more than a decade. She moved to Baltimore several years ago, and she teaches and coaches. She leads workshops as a facilitator for the work of Brené Brown, whom some of you may know of. And she's going to share a story about what it was like to be a priest on a particular Christmas Eve. Please welcome Ariane.
So I love Christmas. First of all, it's the reason I have a job. I am an Episcopal priest. I tend to wear clothes with a much higher neckline during the course of the week. But I love Christmas, and it really grounds everything that I do for a living. And I really especially love the worship that we do at Christmas time, and in particular on Christmas Eve. It is one of the most beautiful days of the church year. A group of parishioners get together, a very dedicated and faithful group, a few days before Christmas Eve and do what's called a greening of the church. And they put beautiful arrangements of flowers everywhere on the altar. Poinsettias abound. They take candles and hurricane lamps and put them in every single alcove underneath every stained glass window, and it's covered with greenery. On Christmas Eve, we sing, beautiful Christmas carols and familiar hymns. And of course, at least at one service, we do a traditional Christmas pageant where you have these adorable little children dressed up as sheep and shepherds and sometimes a camel. Sometimes you have a baby doll that's plastic. Sometimes you have a real baby doll and wise men and angels. And they tell an entirely chronologically inaccurate account of the story of Jesus's birth, but nobody cares, because they are just a joy to behold. But on Christmas Eve 2013, I was feeling anything but joy. I was tired, I was very pissed off at God, and I didn't really feel like I was wearing vestments or my clericals. I felt like I was in a costume and just a total fake, because I didn't know how much longer I could bear telling a story I just didn't believe in anymore. Back in October of that year, my then husband and I had decided to get divorced. We had been together for over 20 years. We had been married almost 2 decades. I met him when I was 18 years old on day 2 of college and said, I'm going to lock this down and just get that rest of my future planned out. So that's the guy I'm going to be with. And just like I could never have imagined at 18 that I would be an Episcopal priest in Baltimore in my 40s, I certainly never thought that I would have a marriage that ended in divorce. I don't know if divorce is harder for a priest. Divorce is hard, as I'm sure some of you know. I don't know if it's harder for someone like me. But when you stand in front of people every week and pronounce absolution and forgiveness of their sins, you kind of feel like the bar set a little bit higher for you. And I was also, by the way, raised Roman Catholic, so like the guilt and shame around divorce were really deep. And I just felt like I was letting everybody down. I live across the street from my church, in a house that's called a rectory. And when a congregation calls a priest to be their rector and live in their rectory, they kind of expect an intact family to be there. And I was pretty sure that was one of my selling points in the interview process. I had a nice husband, I had a beautiful little girl, and we'd been married a long time, so good wife, good mom, she'll be a good pastor to us. So I felt like I was kind of reneging on my part of the deal. And when you cross the street every day to go to work, it makes for a really awesome commute, especially on Sunday mornings. But it also makes for a strangely small world. And so I was living in this one church house with my family that was depressingly disintegrating. We were in separate bedrooms and not telling the truth to our daughter. And then I would cross the street and be in my other church house with this other family that I wanted to take care of and that I loved, but I was totally lying to about what was happening. And I just felt like I was such a failure that I couldn't possibly tell them, and most definitely could not tell them during the holidays. So at this Christmas Eve service, we do multiple services on Christmas Eve, and that year we did 3. And leading worship is an exhilarating experience, but it is also really draining. You just feel like you're really on, and Christmas Eve, you're just packed like you aren't during the rest of the year, except of course Easter. And so at the end of this service, I was just wiped. I remember tripping up in the prayers even. I had nothing left. And so at the end of our Christmas Eve services, we always close by singing Silent Night, but we don't just sing it. Everybody is given a taper candle, and we dim all the lights in the church. And the acolyte comes up to the high altar and lights their taper, and then they go and they light someone in the choir, and then the choir person lights somebody else, and so on and so on. And so the light of Christ is shared throughout the congregation, and it's very quiet and reverent. And then the organ starts to play, and everybody's invited to kneel. And in order for the priest to kneel, I have to turn away from the congregation to kneel at the high altar, which you've spent the whole day facing them like this and leading them in worship, but finally you get to turn and face away and kind of have a moment to yourself and join with the people. And so the music started playing, and I knelt down and pretty much right in, just completely lost it, tears streaming down my face, and then immediately started saying in my head, God, you really fucking suck. I am just so pissed off at the situation I find myself in. I can't do this. I was in advertising. Why couldn't I have gotten divorced back then? That would have been no problem. Nobody would have cared. I fucking met my husband at 18. Like, how the hell do I date? Like, how do you date when you're a priest? Like, I don't even know if that's allowed. How does this work? I was just like, I can't do this. I can't live this way anymore, and I just don't want to be fake. I can't live into all this nonsense and bullshit. And so, of course, because whenever I mouth off at God, like, the response is instantaneous. I just hear the voice back saying, like, good, because I don't really want bullshit. And I didn't bust into this world to become a perfect person or a perfect priest, definitely not a priest. I just wanted to be a human being. And I just want you to know, as a human being, that I am always and will always be with you. And then just the awareness that, you know, keep going. Just keep going. And it was a really, really challenging year that I did keep going. But ever since that moment, I realized that the only kind of priest I want to be is a person who stands with other people when their lives really suck or when they're not, to let them know that God will always be with them too. So wherever you are this holiday season, God loves you. And if you want to sing Silent Night or watch adorable children and you're in the mood for a Christmas Eve kind of worship service, you're more than welcome at Church of the Good Shepherd right around the corner in Towson. Thanks and happy holidays.
Thank you so much. Before I throw it over to the Kolodners to close out the show, we just want to take a minute to thank a couple people that make the Stoop what it is. Our sponsors. If you are shopping and you want to shop local, please check out the logos on the back of our program, Trove, Charmery, Sugar, get that sugar. Clark Burger, Falkenhands Hardware, Conscious Corner, Work Printing, WYPR, all have been great sponsors of the Stoop, and we're really grateful to them. Thank you to the Senator. Thank you to all of the volunteers that make the Stoop shows go. Thank you to our Stoop team, the sound people, Julianne, all the people who help us get this show going. Thank you to the storytellers for this evening for sharing their stories. I love that the stories were funny and sad, had a lot of intestinal explosions, and that if your holidays are great, if your holidays suck, it's all part of the human experience, and we at the Stoop want to hear your stories, so please keep sharing your stories with us. Please have a great holiday or get through the holiday, whatever you need to do this year, and we will see you in the new year. Be safe, and let's enjoy some music from this wonderful group.
Hey, let's hear it for Laura and Jessica and all they do for the Stoop.
Ken Kolodner, Rachel Eddy. I'm Brad Kolodner. Have a great night. Happy holidays. Happy New Year, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening to this live-to-tape broadcast of the Stoop Holiday Hootenanny, recorded at the Senator Theater in Baltimore. We want to do a special shout-out to Sean Wilson, Julianne Franz, Luke Spicknell, and Aaron Curtis, who are our team, our production, photography, stage management, recording team that keep us operating like a very
the well-oiled machine that we are, breaking down every other day.
Poorly oiled machine. Have a great holiday. Stoop thanks you for listening.
We'll see you back next week.